2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock bands. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, honored by his band's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it's part two of the best of Mark Knopfler's Dire Straits.
Really got to want to do it. You've just got to be quite single-minded about that and soldier on and laugh it off. And if you haven't got a sense of humor, then you are dog meat. Was one of the things about MTV that struck me was that it was influencing children seriously. That 9-year-olds were into this.
Big time.
I saw a little boy in my head, and like a Peter Pan or a graphic, and you're flying across a landscape, and you're zooming through it and right up into his window. It's like something Steven Spielberg would do. That's how I saw it. The TV light.
Working.
Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits in the studio.
Nearly 40 years had flowed by since the London-based Dire Straits first overflowed its banks in fall 1978 with a worldwide hit, Sultans of Swing, on its very first attempt. Just prior to summer 1985, Dire Straits had 4 full albums to its credit, with as many international tours, and had the enviable distinction of being the top-selling recording artist on the new digital music delivery system, the compact disc. But nothing Dire Straits and its intrepid leader, singer, songwriter, guitarist Mark Knopfler, nothing they had experienced up to that point, could begin to compare to the public's response to 1985's Brothers in Arms album, a bona fide cultural phenomenon that has since come to define the sound of the middle 80s. Former university English literature professor Mark Knopfler reminded me in the studio that the song composer can share equal creative license with the novelist, playwright, and screenwriter. But if the composer sings his or her own song too, it's often less accepted for some reason. Here's Mark Knopfler with me in the studio.
I mean, writers take liberties and make things up. They're not necessarily... I mean, a funny thing about songs, a lot of people assume that just because you've written a song, it's written from your heart. It's actually not. I mean, for me, a lot of stuff is invented and comes from all kinds of different reasons, and you fictionalize and you borrow and you might use a little bit of yourself, and it might be about somebody else. The song might work on a bunch of levels. So you protect yourself to a certain extent, or you invent characters and so on and so forth. A lot of people seem to, they're perfectly fine about it with an author, but they're not quite, a lot of people aren't quite so used to that with a song. They seem to assume that a song is just going to be the feelings of the guy or the girl who's singing it, and that's not altogether always true. If you're a writer, you can make stuff up and take liberties, and you can come out being the good guy. I remember I wrote a song called So Far Away, and I said, "You've been in the sun and I've been in the rain." I remember my wife said to me, that, "What do you mean, you know? You've been in the sun and I've been in the rain." So I'm not sure. So it's a double-edged thing.
Originally from the spring 1985 fifth Dire Straits album, Brothers in Arms, that's called So Far Away. MTV was then 3 years into becoming a cultural phenomenon, reshaping fashion, film, TV, advertising, as well as popular music. But it was not without its critics, including one of its beneficiaries, Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits.
It was one of the things about MTV that struck me was that it was influencing children, seriously. That 9-year-olds were into this.
Big time.
And I saw a little boy in my head, and like a Peter Pan or a graphic, and you're flying across a landscape, and you're zooming through it and right up into his window. It's a bit like something Steven Spielberg would do. That's how I saw it. The TV light. Yeah. And also they were running some ads at the time, "I want my MTV," and you'd see the police or somebody would be on saying, "I want my MTV." So I stole some notes from "Don't Stand So Close to Me."
for which Sting's publishers demanded 20% or 15% of Money for Nothing. And that's why he gets a Coke credit writing it, but he didn't actually write it. I just stole five notes from, deliberately from Don't Stand So Close. I mean, just told him about it. I told him that's what I'd done. And he happened to be on holiday in Montserrat at the time I was recording it. So it was perfect. Because at that time, Sting was the perfect MTV creature. So I asked him if he'd come up and sing it, and he was just there like a shot, came straight in and did it, sung beautifully on it.
When did the lawyers get involved? After or up front here?
I don't know. I guess we told him straight away. I told him, I had Ed just call his publishing company and tell him straight away that it was, it was a lift from that dwee dee 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 dee.
But he knew that when he sang it.
I'm sure he did, yeah. I don't know. I would never mentioned it, I guessed. To me, it was just always implicit that it was perfect.
It's obvious. And usually it doesn't go any further than that. Did that cause any acrimony?
Not at all. I don't care about money. I don't care about that.
Money for Nothing was a worldwide hit for Dire Straits in the summer of 1985 from the Brothers in Arms album, which won a Grammy for Best Recorded Sound, while Money for Nothing got the Grammy Award for Best Rock Song that year. But the album also spent an unbelievable 9 weeks at number one in the U.S. in 1985, eventually selling a staggering 26 million copies worldwide. This kind of superstardom couldn't have happened to a more reluctant rock star than Mark Knopfler. And trust me, there's no way to prepare for it.
And people's preconceptions, misconceptions about you, and then all the rubbish that gets written as well. You just have to come to terms with it. If you've really got to want to do it. You can't get upset. I've seen people when they've read the first interviews, nonsense. You get used to all this stuff, lies and just pure nonsense. There's no the libel laws. The laws about all that. You don't have to tell the truth. As long as it's not libelous, it doesn't have to be true. And so you just have to get used to it. You've really got to want to do it. You've just got to be quite single-minded about that and soldier on and laugh it off. And if you haven't got a sense of humor, then you are dog meat in this. The way that I like to approach it is a lot of invective, a lot of abuse, a lot of swear words, and a lot of jokes. And that's one of the things I like about Nashville, too, is that easygoing approach to it and not taking it too seriously. I think if you let things get to you, if you take yourself too seriously, or take the work all too seriously. I'm talking about an approach. Obviously you're serious about it. You're serious about music. But having said that, that's a given. That's something that everybody understands. But then having they understand that, then you just get on and just take the rise out of each other all the time or insult each other. And just that's a good way of doing it. If you haven't got a sense of humor in a band, I think that's you'd be missing the most important thing to survive, as well as the willpower. You need a lot of willpower. You've really got to want to do it.
Doing the Walk of Life, originally on 1985's Brothers in Arms album from Dire Straits. Next, Mark Knopfler tries to surf the tsunami of success. Follow In the Studio on Facebook at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits, just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
This is Mark Knopfler. Welcome back in the studio for the best of Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits.
I'm Redbeard with the best of Dire Straits Part 2. Propagated by the undersea earthquake of sales from the Dire Straits album Brothers in Arms, Mark Knopfler spent the second half of the 80s decade surfing the tsunami of superstardom. It's a delirious, intoxicating, surreal ride of excess and largesse that threatens to drown you in everything you've ever wanted. And it's done almost completely in public, whether you want it or not, according to Mark Knopfler.
And just because something is massively commercially successful, it doesn't stop you being, that's no reflection on the quality of what it is. It can still be average stuff and do well. Everything demonstrates that I'm sure that a lot of the top movies that people are going to see wouldn't, In my book, there wouldn't be movies that I would necessarily want to go to. A lot of the time I find myself out of step with what people say is popular, you know, which is the record becomes popular. I mean, I think sometimes a record, an album becomes popular simply because you get a bunch of hit singles away. And so you sell a lot of albums because people want to get all those songs on that particular thing. And there they all are. They're all in there. So that has a big bearing on it. Then again, you know, there was the 80s and I think it was a boom time. And who knows? That can't affect you. You can't let things like that sidetrack you. You can't be sidetracked by anything particularly. You mustn't let people interfere with your happiness, whoever you are, whatever you are. I mean, obviously you've got to feel, you've got to be human, you've got to feel, and you've got to feel disappointment the same as other people do and everything else, and you've got to feel the joy of that. You can't say I have no feelings, you know. You have to find them for yourself and everything else. But writing is in itself a kind of therapy, I suppose. You find things out yourself and then you move on to the next stage.
A full 6 years after the Brothers in Arms album, Dire Straits finally followed it up with the album On Every Street, containing the song Calling Elvis. It's a frequent subject for Mark Knopfler.
Well, I think he was a beautiful young person. That's fate. I mean, that's the truth. He was a beautiful young thing, and he admired James Dean, and he admired Marlon Brando, and it shows you what kind of a grip that Hollywood had then. And even before that, the grip that Hollywood had, the influence it had, you know, to me, because the music was everything, you know, and the rock and roll was everything. And so I was kind of, I suppose, naive, and still am kind of surprised by the tenacity with which he attacked the Hollywood thing. In 65, Elvis was at the top of his game, you know, musically he was still swinging big time. But there was this sense, this feeling that the movies were just going the wrong way. And in fact, he is reported as having said that it was making him ill, you know, that these bad movies. And then I was just, I suppose, again, this time's changed. People don't, I suppose, I was thinking about the fame game now, you know, rock star TV and the fame shows and the kids who want to be famous. And have we addressed this fame thing in any more of a mature way? Are we addressing it more in a more mature way now than we did back then? I don't know.
I asked Mark if he saw any parallels to Elvis Presley and the career and early death of Michael Jackson.
They're just beautiful young people who get involved in the music business as well as they're getting involved in music. You know, when you get involved in music, that's all very well. But you have to get involved in the music business too, and they're two separate things, as Elvis found out. And of course, with Elvis as well, there was the movie business and the movies which he loved, and the movie business, which I'm sure he tried to stay, he was kept at arm's length from. When you get a beautiful young person who can sing and dance, you know, at the same time, which is a clever trick if you can do it, it's going to cause a little bit of a fuss, and especially when they're so young, you know, as Michael Jackson was. So when kids are deified and when kids are worshipped, it's not a healthy thing, and it leaves its mark on any kid that's been worshipped, mass worshipped that way, not worshipped by parents, you know, but which of course all children should be. But kids that have, you know, been involved in all this mass, you know, they're either movie stars or child singers or child actors. You know, there's always a price.
On Every Street comes from 1991. Still to come, Mark Knopfler finds the waters of Dire Straits way over his head. He'll explain why he retired the franchise, but not from making music. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, congratulating Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits on induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
This is Mark Knopfler. Welcome back in the studio for the best of Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits.
George Harrison and John Fogerty each told me that pop stardom in their early 20s had a surprising downside. Both Harrison and Fogerty felt it had retarded their natural learning arc as guitarists, as pure musicians. Now, you became an international pop star in the mid-80s with Brothers in Arms. Can you empathize with what Harrison and Fogerty felt in that regard?
Yeah, of course. It changes your life. I mean, it actually happened before that. It happened with the first album. You know, back in, you know, around 78 or whenever. And yeah, I mean, when you're young, I mean, I was older, thankfully. But when you're a baby, you know, you're in a kid in your teens, it's a heck of a thing to be able to survive it, let alone anything else. It's an unforgettable experience. I mean, you feel as though you're being unraveled a lot of the time. You know, it's like somebody's got a thread on your sweater and just keeps pulling at it. Especially for somebody who's interested in looking at the world, and then they're then subject to the world looking at them in a way that they wouldn't look at anybody else in an ordinary sense. You know, the fame you realize is like a byproduct of the success. You know, and success is something I'd recommend to anybody. I can't think of anything good about fame particularly. I mean, if you can, let me know. Well, I think, yeah, if your personal life is not together, then, you know, and you sort of either running away from it and or whatever you're doing, and I suppose at one point I was, and you're getting on the other side of the world and you can get away from, you let your personal life get away from you for whatever reason. The thing got very big, and with the Straits, I've had a great trip with it. You know, I loved it all, but it was... It came coming with a lot of baggage, a lot of stuff, a lot of people, and so on and so forth. And I think I felt that my writing was starting to slip away from, you know, just in some way. I wanted to get back in touch with the guy who sits in a room and writes a song, and you know, maybe records it, and then maybe goes out and plays it for some people, but. To just try and get everything in back to a kind of an optimum size and in perspective. I suppose when everything else is happening in a big way, but you're not happy, then you're not happy. You know, that will underline that dissatisfaction. That dissatisfaction will be somehow underlined because the success is contradicting it, if you know what I mean. In other words, you're telling yourself, come on, man, you know, you shouldn't be getting down about this. Look at everything else, you know. But having said all that, I'm usually pretty cheerful. I mean, I do think that the sense of humor is probably the most important thing that you can have to do this, because you really got to want to do it, you know. So the thing that that bands always share, nearly always, in my experience anyway, is a sense of humor to get on through. But I did have a sort of a negative period, yeah, I mean... back in the 80s sometime.
So, was Mark Knopfler wise to scuttle the Dire Straits luxury liner and take a sizable audience with him, or just lucky?
I always feel when somebody says you're lucky, you're so lucky to have, you know, I always feel a little bit of a twinge, and I always think, well, you know, thanks, but I always feel like saying that you make your own, because you have to work hard for everything, you know, you have to work hard for every lick that you ever learned on the guitar, and you have to. And I don't sit around and tell you how long it's taken me to write this song or that song. I don't go around saying how tough it is. But on the other hand, I feel incredibly lucky. I feel incredibly fortunate. So, and to have the gift of being able to write a song and for it to make thousands of people happy at one go is a wonderful feeling. And it's a tremendous affirmation and confirmation that you're doing something that people respond to, and it's a great thing. I respect it. I try and respect that talent. But the whole area of luck, I mean, one little move to the left or to the right, you know, and things could have been very, very different. And it's a whole weird thing. I do think you need to have some determination. And that's as important, really, sometimes, as having some talent. But it's not something that I have cut-and-dried views about. I'm not a fatalist by any stretch of the imagination, but I really think you have to show up, and I really think you have to get, you know, behind the plow and get on with it.
I asked former Dire Straits leader Mark Knopfler how he's learned to embrace his own past rather than running from it.
I suppose it's part of growing up and realizing how much they mean to people, how much those old Straits songs really mean to people. They write to you, they tell you what they've done with the music, how they've lived to it, how they've celebrated with it. It's connected with their births, sometimes their deaths, their parties, their weddings, loss and celebration. And some of it's very moving. You know, I got a letter last week from a boy who said the music gave him courage. It's from people young and old and from all over the world. And it's wonderful. It's tremendous, and it means a lot to me. Now you realize that when you show up in their part of the world to play Brothers in Arms or Romeo and Juliet or whatever it is, Sultans of Swing, I just try and play the song as well as I can for those people. I like playing those songs. And I don't mess with them so much that they're unrecognizable, hopefully, because it's important to them. It's great that everybody has their own little corners of the music to and it for themselves, and that's a wonderfully rewarding for me. You drop these songs into the well, and the ripples go out, and the signals come back to you in the most amazing ways. You know, I see the stage. I'm on tour and with my band, and it's a wonderful experience and everything. And you look at the equipment going in and the rows of instruments and these amazing players and the drum kit and the guys setting it all up, and then you think, well, it's actually based on a kid that just picked up a guitar and strummed a couple of tunes. That's the basis of the whole thing. And I try and stay in touch with him. Try and stay in touch with the idea of sitting around playing some songs on an acoustic guitar or two. And I try not to get too far away from all of that.
I'm Redbeard, congratulating Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits for their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Mark Knopfler. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Annie Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.